Good afternoon and welcome everybody to this session of the Queenscliff Writing Festival. And I'd like to start by acknowledging the Wathaurong people, the traditional owners of this land, and to pay my respects to the elders past and present, and to extend that respect to other Aboriginal people present. Now today's session is Migration, Refugees and Hope. And we have two authors to help us to find our way through the various issues that come from this topic, and I'd like to introduce them now. Mariam Issa, who fled Somalia in 1998 and came to Australia via Kenya, Uganda, Qatar. Her book, A Resilient Life, is the story of that journey and how she integrated into the Australian community. And Alec Patrick, who describes himself as a bookseller, a teacher of creative writing. He's the author of two short story collections, and his debut novel, Black Rock, White City, won the Miles Franklin Award in 2016. So perhaps if I could start with you, Mariam, perhaps you could just tell us something about your journey to Australia and the beginnings of your book, A Resilient Life, and how it came to be. Thank you.
And actually the book originated from just some diary notes that I kept. And it wasn't an intentional setting to go out there and write a book. So that was the humble beginnings. And the working title at the time when I really wanted to put the book forward was Being Black in Brighton. So the title was Black in Brighton. And then as I talked about the title, some people started, you know, it became political, and that's why it took this other turn to become A Resilient Life, which I feel is a better title, actually. And so I came to Australia with four children, and I was pregnant with my fifth child and with my husband. So by the time we reached in Australia, I believe that we were really one of the very luckiest refugees, because I came through the reunion visa and I was also processed offshore. So by the time we reached here, everything was really smooth. We had a very smooth transition into the system, and then, you know, the government placed us in a home, which was in Brighton, and at the time I didn't realize what Brighton meant. But, you know, over the years, as I became a speaker and I shared my stories, I saw the anger in people when I said that the government placed me in Brighton. They gave me a home. And unfortunately, I think by using the way we use language sometimes also irritates people, because I would say, oh, the government gave us a house in Brighton, you know? And the people would take that as a literal, like the house belonged to us. So I got a lot of anger from that, and a lot of, you know, our resentments were, you know, shown to us because of that. And then I just corrected my language around that and, you know, started to use. So again, I think with the way I wrote the book, I had a real understanding of connection with words, because words are very, very important, and they can mean a lot to ourselves. And I think we can heal with words, or we can destroy with words. And coming from that oral culture, I have, you know, a real deep connection with words, and how it is important that we use the right context and the right way to write, or even to speak to others. So, yeah.
Okay, thanks Mary. Now, Alec, your book certainly is a fiction book, so different from Mariam's book, but I understand that it did come out of your own sort of family experience and their experience from leaving Bosnia before the war, I think, and you actually were a baby, I think, when you came to Australia, if that's correct. But so why did you sort of choose that sort of way of describing that story, and perhaps not writing as a non-fiction and more historical or personal piece?
Well, fiction offers a kind of a distorted mirror that somehow, through those distortions, offers a better portrait of who we are, you know, and our internal universe. It wasn't an autobiographical book, but biography is always something that has a major part to play in a book. Anything that feels resonant with truth, and that's what fiction does really well, I think, is that it offers us experiential truth, which is to say, truth we can experience, and when we hear it, we resonate to it. If it doesn't have truth, it can entertain us, but it doesn't have that deeper sort of sense of resonance as we read it. I've got to say, I didn't start off with any kind of agenda to address any kind of issue. My only objective in writing the book was to, there's just so much to why you write a book, but it certainly wasn't with some kind of political sort of, idea in mind.
Yeah.
But I'm delighted for the book to address an issue as important as the question of refugees in this country. It's a vital question to address, and I feel that generally speaking, we ignore it. You know, especially in fiction, there's very few books that are written about it. The difficulty in publishing Black Rock, White Sea was a very difficult book to publish. Every publisher rejected it on the basis of a synopsis, not in terms of reading it and thinking it's not good enough to read, but on the basis of a story about refugees from the Bosnian War. No publisher was interested to even consider it. Even my own publisher, the one that eventually published it, rejected it on the basis of that. It was only because when I started talking to him about a previous book that he published, and we were just talking about that, and I started to, it's not only about refugees from the Bosnian War. It's about Melbourne. It's about life in Victoria. It's about the experience of people who have come here, and that is such a common experience. You know, I've been amazed by the reaction to the book, how many different kinds of backgrounds people have had that have brought their grandparents to Australia. Because it's always been an extreme situation, you know. For the first 150 years, Australia was a really difficult place to come to. I read an interesting book called Writers in the Wilderness. It was a really great concept for this particular book because it was the very first letter back to England from, Sydney. It was the very first, poem that was written in Australia, the very first short story that was written in Australia. You know, all these very first, and then it just went on from that. And in that way, they constructed this history of the Australian experience. And pretty much all the way through to, for the first 150 years, it was like, this is hell, this is awful. This place is so difficult, And they're all, still dealing with this sort of idea of these green sort of hills of England, That sort of nostalgia for that particular experience. So that everyone, which is to say that everyone that came here was coming here because of some kind of catastrophe, some kind of crisis, or something that had forced them to come here, like being a convict. It was that, and then I thought to myself after I'd finished Black Rock, White City, that my characters who have been forced out of their own, out of their homeland because of that war, were essential Australian, it's essential to the Australian experience that, they represented that sense of crisis and that Australia is a possibility of a resolution to crisis, it's a possibility of moving forward. So, I was surprised myself that the book eventually became that way. But you asked me about my background. My parents didn't come from Bosnia. My parents came from Belgrade in Serbia when that was part of Yugoslavia. And they simply came here, and then the idea, like a lot of immigrants, was that they'd come here for a few years, maybe make some money, go back over there. It's very difficult for someone to say, I'm just going, never coming back to anyone I know, So they came over here, and as I started, I grew up in the western suburbs of Melbourne. And the western suburbs of Melbourne, I used to think was very multicultural. It really isn't multicultural. It was just European. There was lots of Anglo-Saxons, but there's a lot of Italians, Greeks, Germans, just very various Europeans. It was still kind of like the white Australia policy, but just sort of expanded a little bit to include continental Europe. So that was just the early 70s as my parents came. I was born in Belgrade, but I came over here when I was one. What was interesting though was, and also incredibly painful, was that a lot of the former Yugoslavia had settled around where my parents settled. So we had Croatians, we had Macedonians, we had Bosnian, you know, Muslims, and all kinds of those. And as the war was happening in Bosnia, that war was playing itself out on TV, but it was also playing itself out in our playgrounds. You know, kids were singing these, like I knew Croatian kids that were singing these Nazi sort of Ustashi, you know, war songs, you know, like I don't know where they'd learnt it, you know, to me and my brother, you know, they were next door, and it was like you're friends with them, but then you're also enemies in this weird way. So there's just this strange way in which it was deeply, deeply personal, and yet very far away. And it was a horror show. 10 years of this, you know, it was longer than that. What was happening over there was just so horrific. And for most people in Australia, they could just look at that war and say, well, those just barbarians over there. Those monsters are just doing things to other monsters, and they could dismiss it, you know. Whereas for me, I couldn't dismiss it. I couldn't say that. I couldn't find that moral sort of escape route that says those people, you know. And this is what leads us to the refugee question, I feel, is the ability to say those people rather than us. To see within us that experience of the necessity to come to Australia, that we needed to come here. Whether you were from the UK or wherever you were, Australia was a necessary place to come to offer a possible future when futures have collapsed. So the question of the refugee question isn't only about a horrific situation, but just a process in which people are forced out of their culture and out of their home, and with the opportunity of having a better life. And that, to me, is essential to the Australian sort of question.
So I might sort of pursue that a little bit later, that whole sort of feeling of getting into the head of people who've had to make that sort of decision. Now, your characters, Hovan and Susanna, it seems like they might even survive the experience, that their marriage might not survive, or they might not survive as individuals. I'll come to that in a minute. But, Mariam, I wonder if you can say something about that experience of carrying with you to another country that the horror of war and those experiences. Is that something that you think refugees can escape from, or is that something that they're stuck with?
I think it can become a trap for refugees if they haven't had the ability to pursue who they are and to really look at the issue. And especially in my culture, it was very hard because we don't believe in mental health and seeking help when it comes to, you know, dealing with these issues. So it was just, you know, worked out through storytelling, through gatherings, through the community context. And so for me, I think what made my experience different is the fact that when I came, I was already speaking the language and I had children. So when you have children as a mother and you're already speaking the language, and my husband did not have a word of English, he spoke Italian. So he had to go straight away back to school and start over. So he was a vet. And he was transitioning. He didn't know what he was going to transition to, but he just wanted to have the language. So he started doing English courses. And it became then my responsibility to bridge the gap between myself and my children and the community that we were in. And I also happened to have an incredible father-in-law who was very much connected with his community and knew of what, you know, the refugee context was. And they came before us, and he knew how the Somali community were really suffering, and because most Somalians do not speak English. So he pushed me into doing interpreting job to go and support the community in the ways that I could. And I'm so glad he did that, because what I discovered in that journey was the fact that the problems that people were going through, the effect that and the disconnect that they were feeling away from home. And Somalia is a very homogeneous community. We've never, although we are of a nomadic culture, we've never interacted as much with Western communities. And so coming all the way from that context of our culture, a nation which had the same language, the same religion, the same everything, to straight away into this Western context was a huge quantum, I call it a quantum leap. And it was like sort of an alien world that we have come to. And so it needed a lot of adjusting. It needed a lot of adjusting. And I saw a real disconnect and displacement and depression in the community. And my ability of interpreting, and I was doing solely on health. I used to go to hospitals. And so I would go to hospitals where, you know, people were facing issues of depression, or they were facing issues like young people who came with other families as their parents and they were not their parents, who were facing the disconnect again, and who were mistreated, and who were having mental issues. And so all this was like on a platter, and I could see it. So somehow, somewhere, I think it worked for me as a therapy to work on my own issues. And I started to have the journal, and the journal really helped me by, you know, answering these questions. And as even a young girl, I think I was a contemplator, and I'm a very faith-based and very faithful woman, and very religious at that time. And I would go back and really connect with God and ask questions, and why was this happening, and then write down these issues. And I think that really helped me through this disconnection. But it is still something that is going through in the Somali community, not only the Somali community now, but many African communities, especially the Sudanese communities who came after us. And our children, I think, sometimes become become the price to pay. I think we come with a hope and a feeling that things will be different and things will work out for us. But unfortunately, sometimes it can end up in being worse than what the war was for us. Because I have seen families who had to go back, sometimes just one parent, where he'd lose his wife, he would lose his children through the pipeline to prisons, and he would just, he could not, you know, continue with what had happened to his family, and he would just have to go back. And I've seen many, many families, you know, destroyed in that sense, and sometimes destroyed in the ways of children also having this disconnect and leaving their families and wanting to find their identity. Because I think children are being pushed into a hard, between a rock and a hard place. They come home and we want to keep the culture and we want to teach them what we have. And then they go out there and then they're pushed out as, you know, and like they want to belong into the community and they have peer pressures and things like that. And so I think I was really very, very lucky in the sense that some of those issues, when they touched me, I took the choice or had the courage to really just go out there and understand the community so that I can raise my children better because of what I had seen with other families.
So in making that sort of transition, that label of refugee, is that something that you can eventually discard, or is that something that sort of, is that part of the transition?
I think that is part of the transition, but what I think is like, what is the agenda behind the refugees? What is the communities that we come to? What do they see the refugees as? And what do we see ourselves as refugees when we come to this new environment? So I think the two things that really popped out for me, and we still have and are struggling with, are respect and acceptance. I think those are the two things that most often people do not, they don't respect you because there is a label on you. And we're really good at this as human beings. We love putting labels on things. And that's all well and good when it's in context to some things. But when you put a label on someone, and you make them something that they are not. Because sometimes you don't even know this person, and just the word refugee makes them different or makes alienates them from you. And the fact that you have a certain idea in your head about what a refugee looks like or what a refugee is, then that kind of stops the boundary of acceptance. How am I going to accept this person? And that I use a simple story that I use all the time, was the story of my neighbor and ourselves. Like when we resided in the Brighton home for only 2 months, our neighbor came home and he knocked on our door one night and he said, "By the way, my name is John, I'm your next door neighbor, and your children's ball is in my courtyard. And they, you know, my dogs dig, I don't like that. Could you not allow them to have their ball, or, you know, to do that again?" And for me, you know, we didn't understand that, because at the time, I also say that at the time we were watching Neighbours. But how do you, you know, how do you understand a neighbour coming and complaining about, you know, your child's ball going in there? All he had to do is just, you know, throw the ball back. But it didn't happen that way. And so you understand, and in our Somali culture, we say, you know, we use words sometimes to say something like that. The cry is far beyond what it seems. So it looked like that. So and we knew that there was that fear. But again, we have a perfect system within all of us that makes us universal, and that's the universe. And just a week or 2 weeks later, John's children's ball was in our backyard. And my children were very excited over the concert. They said, "Mom, we have the ball. What do we do now?" And they were bursting with curiosity. They wanted to see that double story house and how it looked like. And they said, "We should go to John." And I said, "No, you throw the ball back." And actually the story continues to just Mohammed one day mowing the lawn outside, and of course we were keeping up with our neighbors in Brighton. And he managed to do a little bit of John's area, and John happened to be home that day, and he came out with two beers and said, "Thank you, mate." And he took two unconsumed beers, because Mohammed doesn't drink, to start a friendly neighborhood. So I think it's just the sharing of, you know, once you become neighbors and once you start talking and once, you know, the fear gets out of the way, then I think it's a way of starting a conversation.
Mm-hmm. And Alec, just sort of lingering on that question about making the transition from what is, I think you described your two characters as really dealing with the anxieties and griefs of the displaced. Holban and Susanna, it seems like they're not going to make it. The gap is just too big, really, for them to actually escape what they've been. They've been through terrible things, and you know, they've, well, give too much away, but they have been through a terrible experience. It looks like they won't survive.
Well, I think there's different people that deal with the same kinds of circumstances in different ways, you know. And in this case, it's a couple dealing with the loss of their children. They died during the war. And poor Jovan, the main character, he really can't find a way to recover from that. He won't allow himself to recover from that. Whereas Susanna, who initially dealt with it even worse than he did, he stayed alive really for her, and she was willing to just, you know, exit. But she seems to have gone all the way down into the depth of that experience and found a way back out of it. And for me, Susanna is like the real hero of the story of Black Wakwasi, where he can't find a way out. She is finding a way out. She's finding that it's necessary to tell the story. That story of their, not directly like an autobiographical experience of their lives, but to simply be able to tell the story of her people and her family, and find a way for those lives to be significant again, for that to be a part of a story that she can share. And, you know, what Mariam's talking about is really fundamental, the ability to that we can like create, we can hear stories, and within those stories recognize a broader sense of humanity. And that's what is so vital about stories. And that's, you know, like not like the political objective of my character. She finds it deeply necessary to find within herself a way to speak from that level of the loss and pain and you know, of a particular history.
Mm-hmm.
And for that history to somehow find its way out into the broader culture that she's becoming a part of, she feels herself becoming a part of. You know, the ways in which, well, like Marion was saying about how we become involved in our cultures, in the culture that surrounds us. What's significant about Susanna's journey is that, like a lot of people that come to this country, whatever the cause is, you can come as a, you know, a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, and suddenly you're a cleaner and you're doing some kind of basic job, you know. That's happened to a lot of people, and that's true for my characters as well. They're academics back in Bosnia, but now they're cleaners. But her being a cleaner has brought her into a closer contact with a particular family in Black Rock, you know. And they've got a kid, and they're having a pregnancy, and it's one of those difficult pregnancies. I forget what the technical term for it is, but it's where a woman has to stay in bed basically for 8 months, otherwise she risks miscarriage, you know. So it's really precarious sort of daily sort of situation. And she's drawn into this family as just as a cleaner, but she's got a kind of resilience that family admires, and become more and more dependent on that resilience in her.
Mm.
But her being part of that family, seeing how much it means to them to have another child, even though they've already got children, makes her, it reawakens something in her. And so she wants to have children again, despite the fact that she's lost, you know, two of her children. And so that's the sort of forward movement of the story, and that's the way we become linked into each other's, like, not only like the stories we tell, but the stories that we live and share with each other, you know. Essentially, that's what we are, you know. We are a narrative. Each person is a narrative. If we don't have a narrative, we've got nothing. We are the story we tell ourselves of our lives. But it's a richer story if we keep on understanding how it interconnects, and it's made richer through the interweaving of other people's narratives and other people's stories as well. Because we are all linked, you know. So just
picking up on that theme of storytelling, which you both mentioned, the power of storytelling, which is the theme of Queenscliff Festival. What is it? So storytelling is more than just giving information. For you, Marion, is there something in your traditional sort of art of storytelling that takes it further, that says more?
Yeah, I think for us, before we were known for being the nation of pirates, we were the nation of poets. And I think because we were an oral culture, it was the way that the wisdom of the culture was passed on to the young ones. And there were specific young people chosen for their memory, for their ability to carry on the story. And so when the story is being told, we were also taught how to listen. The biggest part of storytelling, we might be the ones who are on stage here, but you are the ones, I think the listeners are the most important ones. Because it's about, you know, how you take on the information and decode it, how you understood it. And it's important, I think. And I think in our world, why we're in chaos today is the way I think we interpret, or the way we use language and we dismantle it is so different. And especially if you're taking on someone else's language. Because I speak four languages, and I know that, you know, every language calls for something that is different. For instance, I speak Swahili, which says is incredible, because in Swahili the listening aspect is more a feeling. So even when they're feeling hungry, they say, "I'm listening hunger. I'm listening to hunger." So the nasikia is I hear. So they will say, "I hear hunger." And what they really mean is that I feel hunger. And so the power, I think, of story is in the richness of the language and in the understanding of that language and in the metaphoric, the way we metaphorize things and the way we use the metaphor. So our language is a very rich language in metaphors, in the way we use it, and it's also mostly connected with nature and with animals, because that's where it's originated. So a Somali poem could only talk about the love for the camel or the love of the land, and the woman might talk about how she built a home or she did, you know, she took care of the animals or things like that. So it might not be in the same. And I think that's, as human beings, what makes us very rich is when we take these stories and we listen to these stories and then we use those stories to enrich our lives. And as a young girl, I learned myself how to read. And it was the best thing that I ever did. I read English, and I was reading books like The Famous Five when I was a young girl. And for me, it was so alien. I never thought that there were people who existed with blue eyes and white skin. So it was just like a concept, an imaginary world that I visited. And sometimes, even in my thinking now, I believe that I have created some of my now visions of what I do now through those times of storytelling and of imaginations and of my want to see these people or to be able to interact with them one day. So that is the power of storytelling. I think it can alleviate us from also spaces when there are spaces of dark. And that's what my diary did for me. Like, I would really transcend the horror of the story that I had lived, and I would start writing my future. So in some ways, I say that I became a visionary storyteller. So I could look into the visions of what I wanted my life to look like, and then I would put it into writing. So stories are just incredible.
So what's Mariam saying about the preoccupation and the power of words and language seems to find an echo in Black Rock, White City, in that words are such important things. I mean, both Susanna and Hovan are very preoccupied with poetry and the meaning of words and phrases, and there's all that graffiti that appears on the hospital walls. Words are really... Is there sort of a similarity in what Mariam's saying, or is there that sort of power and preoccupation with words and language?
Yeah, well, words, you know, that's what created the initial idea of the novel. Was I had this sort of idea of the way words function as a kind of disease, that, you know, that's the way words spread sometimes, disease like. I think there's a guy called Emil Durkheim who actually literally starts looking at language as a kind of disease, just in the way it functions, the way English has grown and the way it accepts different words to keep on growing, and it's now become the dominant language in the world, you know. It's interesting always for people like Mariam and myself who have got an original language and arrive to English and accept English not only as language but also as a shared history as well. So words are absolutely essential. Words are coming out of the walls were literally like a disease at the hospital, you know, and I had to have like a character who was going to clean that away. And he was a Bosnian refugee, and he was a poet. And I found that there was this really interesting dialogue that was happening between what was being put on the wall, which is this really sort of violent, virulent sort of disease-like, you know, infestation, you know. And the reply from Jovan was always from this lost poetry, this abandoned poetry that he'd sort of, you know, left back in that war, you know. And that was the sort of dialogue that was like going through the whole book, is this, you know, words as destruction, words as death, words as disease and words as love, resurrection, beauty, power. And it's just this constant battle between these two people, the graffiti and this internal poetry, which no one else hears. You know, they just sort of see this 6'4" guy and they think he's just an oaf. He's like some kind of giant that they, you know, they just point in a direction, he goes, does the work as a kind of, you know, not recognizing the humanity in that person. And I feel like if we're talking about the idea of stories as being part of this festival, and I think that if we look at the way book clubs are emerging all around the country, it becomes such a significant feature. And it's a real phenomenon. I mean, just 10, 20 years ago, they were just like a sporadic sort of occasional thing. I think now it's actually become incredibly powerful. It's become almost like a movement. Everywhere you go, there are communities, you know, and they're always emerging and growing. And I think the reason for that is because that people need to have the ability to connect with another person on the level of being. Because otherwise, they're talking about My Kitchen Rules, or they're talking about the footy, or they're talking about these things that force people to deal with each other only on a very superficial level. So you walk down the street and you're saying, like, you know, hi, what about the weather? The weather's great. That's just like a very superficial way. I mean, it can be meaningful and important, but we need to talk to each other on a level of being, and we don't often have that opportunity. When we have a book, the book opens up an interior space. That's the power of literature, is to reveal interior spaces, because none of us are just these superficial reflections. I mean, you don't see me. You see a body and you see a face talking. You don't see a history, you don't see an experience, you don't see a philosophy. And that's what we love about books. And that's why stories are so important. And I've always loved books, because they give me that sense of travel and movement and development, because I can move in through history. I can move all the way back to Homer and ancient Greeks. I can move to different parts of the world. And I've always loved that ability to travel to a very different culture and a very different, you know, perspective on the world. You know, I think that has always given me that sort of thrill of broadening my sense of humanity. And that's what's so important to stories and literature, because, you know, the people that are the most, keep them out of here, you know, we need more boats, or we need more soldiers, or whatever else, I guarantee you they don't read at all, you know. They're not reading. If they are reading books, it's just books that confirm their narrow perspective on the world, you know. They don't see the broader sense of humanity. That's what's so important about literature, is that it offers us an experiential movement into the story of another person. And in the hearing, like you were saying, how important it is to hear, in the hearing we have the opportunity of growing. And that's just such a liberating sort of feeling. It sometimes means we have to take on the pain of other people, the loss of other people, but in doing that we find the greater sense of ourselves and our humanity. And it connects us on a deeper level to who we are as a species and who we are as part of a history that's constantly emerging.
Okay, I'm just going to drag ourselves back a little bit to the topic, although it does relate to the topic. And it was my fault. I asked the questions. But, you know, just talking about that sort of transition of the migration transition and refugees making the transition to Australia, and hope being very much sort of the thing that we're trying to emphasise today, and I think that sort of is really coming out. But some of the limits to that, and I'm just wondering why you think it is that, do you think Australians in general really understand what the refugee experience is? You know, we just don't have the experience. Is it a failure of imagination, or just a failure of our compassion, that there are these sorts of resistances at the moment, particularly to migration and to allowing ourselves to become more of a migrant nation, even though we've been doing it since the beginning, since Cook arrived? But, you know, there always seems to be that sort of resistance. Do you think, Mariam, a lack of imagination or a lack of compassion? Why is that resistance, I wonder?
I think that would tie to what Alec was talking about, in the sense that we're not reading maybe enough of other cultures and other people. And my particular experience that I would love to, you know, bring, because now I don't see myself as African, or I don't see myself as white or white. Like, I have lived in different, many different cultures, and my humanity, I think, has become more stronger than just leaning into a certain, you know, place. So I think I've reached that level and space of altruism. And it's my love for connection with people. And one thing that I know and I've written about in my book is the fact that when the white tourists, people who come as tourists into our countries, and of course they come with their own agendas as being a tourist and seeing a beautiful country, but some of them happen to live in the country and then use that country as exploitation. Like, there was a lot of pregnancies for young people, and a lot of things that come with that tourism industry, and that somehow happens to be from the neglect of not connecting with a culture, of not connecting with people from the level which they're living in, and somehow putting yourself in a superior or in a higher space. And having come here, I also, in my world of integration and wanting to be part of this community, I understood that I came with a deflated culture, like deflated cultural currency, because I do believe that culture is a currency. And when I don't understand your culture, there's no way that I am able to relate to what you are talking about. So in that space of wanting to find that, I saw the lack of curiosity in the Western culture, not being curious about the other. Whereas for in our African culture, we feel that we're very, and this is not, me leaning towards my African culture, but we were taught to be curious about other cultures, to understand them, and I think that was our work of employing empathy and the heart, and understanding, other people. And when I came here, I saw the game has changed, because it was about an individual perspective. It was what's in it for me. If I want to understand you, then there has to be something in it for me. Whereas mine was from the communal space. What can we benefit from this? And so I think our lack of empathizing with each other comes from that space. When we engage ourselves so much in the head, so much in the mind, and look for experiences and look for just like what is in it for me, I think we lose that ability to empathize with the other. And that, in all honesty, is what I believe that is now lacking in this space and in these conversations. Because sometimes, even for me, I was, unlike Alec, there were publishers who were interested in my book, but the interest came mainly from the drama of the book. I was a Muslim woman, I was a black woman, I was a refugee, and so my story could sell. And it was purely because of that they were interested in the book. And I could have fallen easily into that trap, and I was willing to give the book to them. But a lot of prayer and a lot of contemplation kind of put me back to a place of alignment and to say, look, this is not exactly what I want from the book. And my intent was very clear of what my book was going to be. I wanted the book to be read by the other and to find herself or himself in that journey with me. And it's incredible because people now call me or write to me and say, oh, that year when you were doing this and this, guess what, I was doing this and this. And so they were walking the journey with me. And if we listen to the refugees and we listen to their concerns and we just sit down in their reality, because we all live different realities. No two people's reality is the same. But if we visit each other in our realities, I think that's the space for compassion. And that's the space where we disconnect from judgment.
Thanks, Mary. So that, I wonder what you think, Alex, that sort of reality of the fact that, you know, there is quite a resistance to understanding the refugee experience. I noticed somewhere that the current Australian population, 26.8% were born overseas. Now, you were one of those. So how do you understand that sort of pushback against the refugee, against the other? What's going on there, do you think?
I'm not a politician, you know, thank God. I don't think it's, you know, like, I don't look at a population of people and seeing just like one kind of person, you know. Even when you're talking about people that are just, you know, like the government, every time it says something like anti-refugee and they're going to be strict or whatever else, straight away, you know, the polls start, you know, going up, you know. It's like guaranteed that when they start talking that way, the general population are responding as though they want that. I think that the general person is just too, like, preoccupied with how difficult the life is for them, you know, just day to day. It's hard, you know, no one's got it easy, you know, everyone's like in a situation where even if they got good employment, they could get sacked, and if they get sacked, they're in immediate crisis, you know. How many people can deal with like losing their job, you know? How many people feel secure that they can just go and get another one if they do, you know? It's a difficult existence, and most people can only deal with the circumstances of their own existence because those circumstances feel so crucial. And, you know, worrying about someone else's life is just beyond your immediate concerns and necessities. So it's not just like racists or, you know, whatever else. It's just that they live circumscribed lives because the pressure of their lives force them into these small existences in which they spend like, you know, 10 hours every day working. Mm. They barely have time for their own kids. Mm. You know, and so they've barely got time for family, let alone expanding their sort of sense of other people and other people's stories, you know. And so this is sort of like, you know, to talk politically, it's like this capitalist sort of idea. You so much pressure put on you, you work so much. You've got little area left for exploring other things like humanity, you know. Mm. But the way I see it is that there's a gradual sort of process in which other cultures become accepted and part of the general sort of perspective of what it means to be Australian. You know, I was really amazed that Black Rock White City was the winner of the Miles Franklin. To me, that was. What was really significant about that was that this was like a multicultural perspective. Mm. It wasn't an Anglo-Saxon perspective, but, you know, this was a different kind of idea of what it was to be Australian. Mm. You know, because 10 years ago, 20 years ago, these weren't even Australian stories.
No.
You know, if you came from Bosnia or whatever, they weren't Australian stories, they were foreigners, you know. Mm. But now we're at a point where we can look at those kinds of experiences and say, these are Australian experiences.
Mainstream.
So it's slowly starting to happen, that, you know. But like I was saying before, where I was raised, it was raised in the kind. I thought it was a multicultural part of Melbourne. It wasn't. It was just that expansion of the White Australia policy. Mm. And you just hope that literature can keep on opening up these definitions of what it means to be Australian. Mm. And all you can hope for is that there's a slow sort of movement towards that. So we can't see that. We can't see that response from the government. The government is totally retrograde in that respect. There's no sort of cultural appreciation coming from Canberra at all.
So just following on that idea of whether we are a multicultural society or not, I know we're very good at congratulating ourselves for being that, but I was interested, I think I heard in one of your interviews where you were pointing out that the former Yugoslavia was in fact a very multicultural society.
Yeah, it was.
And I was interested to know, you know, even though it was multicultural, what went wrong, and then further than that, what are the pressure points in our own multicultural society, you know, to stop it from humming along sort of reasonably well?
Well, you know, there was misinformation when the war was happening. One of the greatest examples of that was that these people had been fighting each other for thousands of years.
Mm.
That this was some kind of tribal thing that we can't understand because it's been going on for such a long time. Who could stop it, you know? Mm.
And it's just not true.
Yeah.
Those various parts of the former Yugoslavia were dominated by empires. Like the Austro-Hungarian Empire had always controlled Slovenia and Croatia. And the place that was Bosnia and Herzegovina was controlled initially by the Ottoman Empire for a long time, and then the Austro-Hungarian Empire seized control of it. Serbia itself was controlled by the Ottoman Empire for most of its history, and had 200 years of separation. But Serbians couldn't fight Croatians. There wasn't that possibility. They couldn't do that. So there was no history at all of warfare between those people.
So what
happened with the First World War is the empires... I mean, the First World War was inevitable because you had imperial powers getting stronger and stronger and stronger. So the Germans are getting stronger, the British are getting stronger, the Russians are getting stronger, the French are getting stronger, and they're all on one little space of land. So, of course, there's conflict. So there's war, and there was, after the First World War, there was the collapse of those empires. We had a different kind of system, and those various parts of the former Yugoslavia were little states now, suddenly, and they decided willingly to create a federation called Yugoslavia. And it didn't matter whether you were Catholic, Orthodox, Muslim, Jewish. The whole idea was that you could be anything, but you were part of this federation. And it was one of the first times we saw a country that was developed from an initiation as a multicultural society. But what was also significant was the way the other countries around there were constantly developing antagonisms between those various states. You know, consciously sort of breeding, you know, hatred and distrust. And
for what purpose?
Well, to disintegrate that part of the world. If they can, they will. Mm. You know, that's just always, that's a natural sort of political thing that governments will always do.
So do you see,
the governments,
so do you see, do you see signs of that in Australia, in our own society?
Yeah, and what's significant, and this is why I think that it's important for us to look at a country like Yugoslavia and say, well, you know, instead of saying it's barbarians or like those monsters or whatever else, no, look at what happened there, because you've got like a laboratory experiment, basically. It says to you, this is what happens if this happens.
Mm.
And if you get someone like a demagogue like Milosevic who comes into power and says, those Muslims over there are responsible for all the trouble, okay? If he starts doing that, suddenly the people that he's talking and he's representing are like these beautiful sort of people that have got no conflict, no, you know, they're above the conflict, they're above that strife, but they're blaming those Muslims over there for doing that. And we've seen that exactly happening in America with Trump.
Mm.
You know, it's exactly the same sort of situation, and we're seeing the exact same kind of disintegration in culture. I mean, how many people in America right now are protesting every day, or how disorganized and how much chaos is now coming into that culture. And as he keeps on going with that, that is going to get worse and worse and worse until you will see social disintegration. It's already happening in the streets, and it's going to continue to happen, and it will break out into a military conflict. The biggest difference between like the former Yugoslavia and our country here as a multicultural country is economics. We're doing well. If everything's okay, and we're sort of like, you know, you can like open a business and whatever else, then those various things, that those kinds of little antagonisms can be just put aside. God forbid this country ever gets to a point where people don't feel that they've got a future anymore. Economically, there's no other options. Then you will see people like Pauline Hanson, and you'll see people like Tony Abbott reemerge with a lot more power and a lot more ability to get people fired up. And then people start firing guns and there's no more conversations. It's as simple as that. And that's why it's so important to look at those people and understand them for what they are. Someone like Trump, someone like Tony Abbott, thank God he's not Prime Minister anymore, but he's still agitating. And someone like Pauline Hanson, still that sort of figure around which there is this just awful, you know, sense of antagonism.
Mm.
But that is like a disease. And it becomes inflamed when a situation becomes bad, let's say, economically.
Mm.
But while the economy is good, that's why it's so important for us to keep on advancing, keep on opening up stories. And I mean, it's wonderful that your story was sought after by publishers. It's really great that that's happening.
So taking on board, that's the reality that, you know, we are seeing those same sorts of pressure points within Australian society. It seems to me that, you know, what we can do against that is the sort of solidarity groups that sort of breaking up at sort of community levels. And I wonder, Maram, if you can say something about the work that you're doing with, I think particularly, is it Resilient Aspiring Women Group? I think you said in your book something that was very interesting. You said that isolation in a new culture, which is what you went through, does lead to solidarity with other women.
Yeah, it does. So much. the work I do is absolutely germinated from my passion, the fact that I came and there wasn't a community around me. And in my African culture, we really believe in, it's a communal culture, and it's, and there is the big proverb that says, you know, it takes a whole village to raise a child. And of course, at that time, for me, struggling with my children and wanting to belong and wanting to be part of this community, I think has led me into understanding the community first myself. So it was a matter of to understand and then maybe to be understood. And so I went in to understand, and I did that in so many different ways. And it was just a mother being wanting for her, you know, children to belong. And I think the penny dropped for me when my four-year-old daughter, who was born in the heart of the community, reached kinder. And one day we just went and looked for a local kinder. And going in there, we received a frosty reception. And again, it comes back to how silence, how, you know, this story, it's not so much about communication, it's not so much about words. It can be silence as well. And so when we came out of the kinder, my daughter asked me, she said, "Mom, did they not want me because I'm black?" And I think that sort of, as a mother, you know, really gave me the power to say, well, is this what I've come for? Mm-hmm. And for me, going and again sharing my story about being an interpreter and seeing those other families, that's what has prompted my need for my children to be able to belong, to not be looking over their shoulder one day and thinking that someone else was better. So that's what gave me, you know, the opportunity to go into the community, and that's how I went. And I did, you know, I worked in community centers, I cleaned Brighton homes, and then I went to aged care centers. And although at that time, you know, I saw all this glamour and glory and the beauty of the Western world, and I was cursing my African world, why did we come from all this? And I realized that, you know, through this journey and through interacting with people and knowing their stories, I realized that amidst the beauty and the glory and the glamour, there was a big disconnect. Because I cleaned really bright, big Brighton homes that not many people lived in. In most cases, we just went in and had nothing to clean. And then I went to aged care centers where, you know, the community, the wisdom of the community was kept away from the community. And then I would, you know, take my children to, you know, shopping centers, and I would see young children roaming in shopping centers. And then I would read the local papers where, you know, maybe an 11-year-old committed suicide. What do they know about life? And then I was exposed into mental health and, you know, isolation, and I saw the disconnection. So that's what made me, and of course my contemplation and thinking about things and writing about them, I realized that I was a seed that germinated in Brighton. I came to remember what I had forgotten about myself. And by, you know, and also to remind others what they had forgotten. And for me, what I saw that I had forgotten about myself was really, it was like a picture one day I saw of this Western woman in Lycra, you know, pushing a pram with one hand and the leash of a dog in another with perfect, beautiful makeup. And for me, it was like, wow, how does she do that? And so it was a sort of an invitation for individuality. A sort of saying, you can do it too. And in me was the cultural, the complexion, the community kind. And so I opened my backyard to bring people together. And mostly my work was with women, and I've seen the disconnect of women in refugee spaces, in even Brighton space. And I often say that I went through life, you know, with three phases. So I was in the victimhood phase, and in that phase I collected a lot and I saw a lot of stories, people who were in that space of victim. And in the anger space I also saw people who were in, you know, their stories. And I realized that our stories were actually all the same. And so one element I think that was missing for all of us was trust, that we did not trust. And the trust isn't that we didn't trust the other, but most of the trust from that. And so my wanting to open my backyard came from that big trust, to create a space where I could trust people to come in to my home and for them to be able to trust me enough to come into my backyard. And the organization has blossomed after that. It's incredible.
Thanks, Merit. Now we are going to open up for any other questions. I mean, I've still got loads of questions too. But while you're sort of getting your questions together, I just, Marian, one thing I'm really curious about in the process of the refugee process is how much of yourself do you have to leave behind, and how much can you sort of hold on to?
I think that process of integration was for me, it's not only integrating into a community, but also integrating the concepts within myself and reconciling with stories. So I had so many stories. I had stories from my cultural background, and then I had stories from the Arab world. I had stories from the native African cultures that I lived with. And then coming to Australia, I also collected the stories of Australia. And so it was about taking these stories and seeing what really resonated with me and what I could benefit, the benefits and what I could use. And so I became, so to speak, like the you know, sieving the sand from the nuggets of gold. And in doing that, I think I became a bridge for the cultures, and to say this belongs to me and this is what I want to keep from my culture, and letting go of the things that I didn't really need. And yeah, sometimes in the context of a Somali woman, I could be seen as really far away from my cultural self, and also maybe even in through my husband's eyes, he could have, you know, he has lost his traditional cultural life. Yeah, and yeah, you become dead to some of who you are and start reliving again. So I truly believe that I reincarnated in my body in this country, and that's the affinity that I have for Australia. I love it so much.
Thanks, Mary. Any questions from the audience? Yes.
Do you think the disconnect, which is a lack of understanding, which then equals fear, is a lot of the factor, you know, with us in Australia not accepting your culture, supposedly?
Okay, I think it's the age of anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a massive amount of fear. You know, I think it's even biological, genetic, you know, as in for thousands of years we were animals. You know, as we evolved, we were animals, we were prey animals. We like to see ourselves as like, you know, apex sort of animals that were sort of hunters and whatever else, but generally we were running for our lives most of those hundreds of thousands of years. So for 200,000 years we've had biologically what we are right now. The machinery for the mind, whatever else, we weren't able to really do much with it. We still live in a really sort of basic sort of level, but it's proven that we were able to understand who we were and what our situation was. And that was 200,000 years of pure fear of everyone dying around you and you knowing what that meant. You dying and knowing that you're going to die one day. So there's just an inordinate amount of fear in our species, in our history as people. So fear always is the thing that we need to sort of deal with. You know, we don't deal with it. And it's always going to manifest in whatever way will come out. We'll be fear, afraid of, you know, someone that looks a little bit different or a different kind of culture. You know, we could be afraid of our next door neighbor who's exactly like us. It doesn't even need to have any kind of difference, you know. What we really need to do is understand fear, understand that that is the basis of conflict. And if we can understand that the basis of conflict, then maybe we could have a different kind of future to what we've had in the past. The longer we don't deal with that central fear, then the longer we'll continue to run. We just keep on running away from our issues, running away from the things that, until we, you know, are caught up by those things.
Mary?
I think humanity is at a crossroads, and I believe, honestly, that we're all here to reconnect. We've lost each other, The myth, I don't know if it's a myth, I don't know if it's the truth that we've all come from one place to begin with and then we have lost our ways. I think this is our space of reconnection, of connecting again to that space, the heart, where we truly, the true love lives in.
Yeah.
And I think that's the whole concept is, are we loving enough to begin with ourselves and then to connect with other people? And I think most of our fears come from that space. They come from the learned cultural, historical stories that is inherent in us through DNA, as Alex says. And so all this is becoming dismantled now. And it's a huge, huge deal for all of us. And I think we're so afraid of polarity as well. We're so afraid of dark and light. Where as a gardener, if you're a gardener, I'm a gardener, nature teaches us that we can coexist with polarity, that it's beneficial for both, you know, both the dark and the light has great benefits for us. And just once we understand how to maneuver and how to connect with it and how to use it, then we have nothing to fear about. So,
Just sort of following on that, do you think within that sort of desire to connect, do we also have to admit to our differences? Is that an important part of it?
That there are, that's what diversity is all about. And I think that's the richness of our histories. That's the richness of who we are. I mean, if we were all black or we were all white or we all had the same story, I mean, the world would be just this mundane, no variety space. But now we have so much variety. We have so much to choose from. And we don't necessarily have to agree with each other either. Like, I can be who I am, but I can respect you for who you are. And it's just bringing that acceptance and understanding of, you know, we can be together without love. And I think we know that in marriage, don't we?
In relationships.
All sorts of relationships, yes. That's all true.
Yeah. Okay, we have time just for one short question, if there's any more. Yes.
In my talking with refugees, I always find it difficult to know how much of the awful past to talk about. And I noticed when you were talking, we didn't hear anything about the awfulness of what you'd had to leave behind. And so for me, the problem is, how much should you forget that? How much can you talk about it with somebody else? How do you deal with it?
Mm. I think it's a beautiful question, and I know that for me, it's, you never forget where you've come from, and you never forget your pain, but you can forgive and let go of the things that don't serve you anymore. And by using the analogy, it's visionary storyteller, it doesn't mean that I'm not my story anymore. But it means that I am growing, and that this person that is here now is a new me. And it's part of evolution. I think we will keep evolving, we will keep growing. And when we hold on to the things that don't serve us anymore, to the pains, I think they become an anchor for us, and they hold us back. And sometimes that can be your own, you know, family or your own relationships that are close to you. You've got to let go if you want to grow. It's hard and it's painful, but you learn to give your light. You can only be of use to anyone when you become the light. And then you can guide the boats to come on shore. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mona. So unfortunately we have come to the end of our session today, but I think you'll agree that our two wonderful authors have taken us in directions that I never expected that we go. But I think you'll agree too that we've ended on a very hopeful note. We've done something with the hopeful part of today's topic. So could you please put your hands together and thank them for coming to our topic. Of course, that's not the end of the festival, and you know that both Patrick and Mariam's books are for sale outside, and there are many other sessions to go in this very successful Queenscliff Festival. So thank you very much for coming, and thank you too for Alec and Mariam too for today.
Thanks to everyone who organises this festival. Queenscliff Festival is lovely. It's my first time here. Thanks to John, who's wonderful. They don't, people that do this kind of job here, they don't get enough credit. Really fun to meet them. And the questions are great, you know, and it's been lovely to be here. Thanks, Marianne, for coming as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I end with the same note. Thank you to the organisers. Thank you to the people who come and listen. I mean, it's without you, who would we be talking to? And thank you, John, for your wonderful...
Thank you to us all.